Most of you know me, Joe Hollander, Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust and the Palmerston North Defence Advisory Group, and it's our pleasure to put on our monthly military, midday military history presentation. So today, we're very privileged in having Colonel Jared McGarriga from the Corps of Royal New Zealand Signals, who's going to tell us a little bit about the centenary that was supposed to happen last year but didn't. And so did happen this year, and that's why he calls it 101. But then it happened in a somewhat more truncated manner, didn't it? So without further ado, can I ask you to welcome Jared, who's going to speak to us.
Thank you. I think I'll try to start with a really healthy disclaimer. So first of all, thank you very much for coming to listen to talk about 100-something years of signals in New Zealand, 100 of which have been under the guise of the Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals. I'm surprised and delighted that this many people had nothing to do today and came to hear this. So thank you. I just want to say I really am a bumbling amateur. I'm not a professor at the Massey. I've written no books, I've read very few. But I did read this one here, Swift and Short. Thank you, Cliff Lord, this is amazing. I've learnt more about my corps and the background leading up to my corps in the last 1.5 days, frantically writing this, than I've known in my 20 years of service. So if nothing else, I've got a lot out of this. So I guess that'll make you all feel good about giving your time up. 80% of the course history I've not seen, I've not lived, I've heard some stories. So I'm really going almost verbatim off what I've read in this book. So if you really want to know, get the book, Swift and Short.
Do you get a commission?
I can only assume it's still available online, I don't know. Right. So I just thought I would just start with some house and grounds about the Corps. So you'll see there on the left, if probably familiar with Mercury, or also known as Hermes, the messenger god, also known colloquially by us as Jimmy. Not 100% sure why. Some people say it's because the image of Mercury was based on a late medieval bronze statue by an Italian sculptor, Jean Bologna. And over time, that name was shortened naturally to Jimmy. Other people say it's because there was a very famous Royal Signals boxer called Jimmy England, who was the British Army champion for a long time. Don't know. But Jimmy. You'll see there that Jimmy wears a petasus, a travelling hat with a broad brim, two small wings. He carries a caduceus, a staff which signifies his office of herald. He stands on a globe, wearing wing sandals which carry him at great speed across the land and sea. The signals badge includes our core motto, Certicito, which means a swift and sure. Our core patron is the Archangel Gabriel. And interestingly, Archangel Gabriel was chosen by vote in the 1960s by the Army Chaplains Department, which was an interesting bit of trivia. And RNZ6 is the only Commonwealth Signal Corps to have a patron saint. Pope Benedict XV. Apparently declared Gabriel the patron of post office, telephone and telegraphy workers in 1921. So, a logical choice for the Corps. Our Colonel-in-Chief, HRH Princess Anne, she's pretty amazing. She was here the other day. Unfortunately, she missed out on a parade. It would have been amazing. But she did meet with a couple hundred of our soldiers, really, really involved in Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals, Australian Corps of Signals, British, Canadians. She's fantastic, and far more than the figurehead that you might assume. And down the bottom right there, we've got our old stable belt. which has the colours green, blue, blue for land, for communications over land, sea and air, which just this last year we upgraded to this. Same colours, but now have a little belt buckle. And that was actually an initiative by our wahine, a woman, to make something more comfortable. Additionally, the big bit of metal there actually makes it it's better as I've aged, and I'm not as ripped as I once was, and so it doesn't fold over as much. Just a little bit of trivia. You won't know what I'm talking about. Here's a brief core timeline. It's sort of, the Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals was 101 years old, but actually the history of signalling in New Zealand goes back to 1860. Really rich history, which obviously has its roots in the Royal New Zealand Corps of Engineering, which is why we're here today. I'll talk a bit about most of this as we go through, but really, really interesting peaks and troughs of the Corps, and what I discovered was a whole lot of trends over the last 100 to 150 years which are still relevant today. It's existed since the dawn of warfare. Commanders have always needed a way to communicate their instructions to large, sometimes distributed groups of soldiers with weather, distance, and noise constant companions. The Bible mentions horn trumpets, smoke. Sun Tzu details the use of drums, gongs, banners, flares, flags. Cyrus the Great, Alexander the Great, the Romans, they all used horse-mounted signal dispatch riders, supported by staging posts with food and fresh horses to carry messages long distances quickly. Torches at night, smoke by day. Communications never stopped. As the years passed by, the need for commanders to communicate remained, but the means didn't vary much. As technology changed, the means and effectiveness of communications were affected. In the 15th and 16th century, with the advent of gunpowder, the noise of cannon made vocal commands more difficult, and the smoke made visual signalling problematic. Drummers beat the charge and regulated the pace of advancing infantry. Trumpeters commanded squadrons of cavalry, but overall communications between a general and his commander were limited, slow and hazardous. In 1815, at the Battle of Waterloo, the only signals given were by officers waving their hats. Wellington had to send his orders verbally or in writing by a mounted aide-de-camp who at best took a long time to pass theirs on and at worst would be unhorsed, wounded, killed or lost. Revolutionary France realised a major advancement in digital communication with the radiated telegraph machine. This was a mechanical semaphore system placed on roads with hilltop relay stations 5 to 10 kilometres apart, and it enabled plain and cipher or coded communications to reach the destinations 90 times faster than the time taken by a mounted courier. Napoleon, huge empire, saw the obvious benefits and erected telegraph stations in all his conquered territories, using for the summoning of reinforcements, relaying his logistics requirements and news of his victories. He was quite the propagandist. In 1837, optical telegraphy received a challenge that would eventually replace it when the American Samuel B. Morse invented electric telegraphy. He invented a code of dots and dashes that we all know as Morse code. It required stations and branches, but was speedier and more certain than optical signalling and could carry messages over vast distances. It was first used for military purposes by the British in the Crimean War in 1854, with a 340-mile-long submarine cable connecting London and Paris with the battlefield. It was then used extensively during the American Civil War and only increased in use after. In New Zealand, the Māori also established their own means of communication. The hikotaha, or sling, was used with darts that had either fire bundles or feathers. Shot into the air, they signalled advance to the left or right or withdrawal. They also used the tifa-tifa, which was an axe-like weapon, to indicate a change of direction, and taiaha were used to signal over distance. Māori could also communicate over large distances. A pahu, large wooden gong, was located in the One Tree Hill area in Auckland, and its signal was said to have been audible over much of the Auckland area. They also used the pukaia, a form of alpine horn that you may have seen at the opening of the Rugby World Cup in New Zealand. Fire and smoke were used. When the Pākehā arrived, cow horns started to be used. An iconic form of communication was the pūtāra, or conch, used by iwi to issue a challenge out to a potential enemy. If the challenge was answered, then war would ensue. A little bit like a haka, I guess. Interestingly, Abel Tasman unwittingly accepted the call of battle when he first heard the challenge by ordering his sailors to trumpet a reply. I guess Sun Tzu was right, you should always know your enemy. You can see two forms of traditional Māori communications here on He Tō Porongorongo, who we know as the signaller, and He Tō Porongorongo features prominently in a lot of our core documentation, and in particular at Two Signal Squadron located here at Lipton Military Camp. With the large-scale arrival of the English came the military and military communication. Drum and bugle were commonplace. The British also routinely used flags, dispatch riders and vessels to relay orders. The Māori watched and learned and adapted, later effectively using flags to signal troop movement and cow horns to mimic British bugle calls, which caused great confusion and could keep British soldiers awake day and night simply through copying the alert signal. Pretty smart. A Sergeant Marjoram from Royal Artillery created a simple but effective semaphore communication network in the Taranaki using a ball system that could warn of Māori warrior movements and enable the British commanders to effectively organise their limited troop resources. Lieutenant General Sir Duncan Cameron arrived in 1861, and with him came more modern communications. Cameron had learned lessons from the Crimean War and from his readings of accounts of the American Civil War, and under his influence, New Zealand became one of the first countries to use the electric telegraph as a major line of communications in war. With Lieutenant General Cameron came two Royal Engineer telegraphists, Corporal Alexander Brodie and Second Corporal William Butcher, go the engineers. Corporal Alexander Brodie is considered the founding father of New Zealand military signals. At just 21 years of age, he oversaw the erection of the North Island's first telegraph line from Auckland through Otahuhu to Drury. It consisted of some 300 kauri telegraph poles linked with number 8 galvanised wire. From there, the network extended south in ever more haphazard fashion using whatever material they could find locally. Stores were manhandled, work parties were often up to their waist in clinging, smelling swamp. However, swift, reliable communications were always important to Cameron. When he invaded the Waikato in 1863, he had local militia guard the telegraph lines to ensure it wasn't cut. The technology was simple. Electric currents were employed to transmit intermittent signals along the line coded with dots and dashes to convey meaning, Morse. But it proved very effective. The telegraph gave warning of enemy attacks reported enemy warrior band movements. It assured headquarters that garrisons were safe and allowed for an efficient movement of supplies and reinforcements. Progressively, the head station in Auckland was linked further with stations in Onehunga, Papakura, Ngāti Wahea, Te Awamutu and Cambridge. The colonial government was very, very quick to use this military communication systems for government and civilian use, and its use continued to spread throughout the land. From the mid-1870s leading up to World War I, the advance and development of military communications in Aotearoa New Zealand came through a series of different bodies that progressively adapted themselves to provide colonial defence. We had the Royal Artillery, who had a cadre of permanent staff, and they were experienced naturally in field and garrison signalling. We had the Torpedo Corps, which I'd never heard of, and it was formed as part of the nation's coastal defence, used in support of coastal batteries to repel would-be raiders or invaders by a combination of gunfire, torpedo boats and mobile land forces. The batteries were linked with telegraphic lines, and telegraphy became a part of the Torpedo Corps training regime. No one ever invaded us. There was also a haphazard system of volunteer units, and they mainly used semaphore and signal dispatch riders. But the Army's permanent staff effectively used telegraph and then telephone to progressively tighten control over these disparate, geographically dispersed units. Within the volunteer movement, the Volunteer Cycle Corps was the most versatile exponent of non-telegraphic signalling. In 1898, just pre the Boer War, five Volunteer Cycle Corps were formed in Auckland, Wellington, Nelson, Christchurch, Dunedin. They were trained in rudimentary signalling and they used their bikes as an effective communication linkage. They were really keen, but they were pretty ordinary. There was increasing pressure as we got into the early 1900s to focus more on professionalising communications. In 1902, Major General Babington, commander of the New Zealand Land Forces, advocated for the establishment and development of support arms. The government refused to fund this, but Major General Babington persisted. Lieutenant Colonel Clayton, who worked with them, recalls that Babington, by clever manipulation of existing corps, was able to establish a de facto signalling corps. Babington argued that a properly organised signalling corps was essential if an army in the field was to be effectively controlled without unnecessary waste of time or horseflesh. In an attempt to solve the complex problem of training signalling specialists, Babington suggested they be recruited from the trained signallers employed in the Post and Telegraph Department. Babington's argument for a separate signal corps did not win the necessary political approval. However, he was able to obtain approval for the reorganisation of both the Cycle and Engineer Corps. Approval was granted for selected members of the Cycle Corps to be trained as signallers, and engineer units were reorganised into three sections: field engineers, telegraphic and signallers. The connection that Babington established between the military and the Post and Telegraph Department, it reaped benefits 60, 70 years later. This connection stood the Defence Department well in two world wars. The Post and Telegraph Department cooperated by allowing selected personnel time for military duties. These trained telegraph operators and linemen, and later telephone operators, provided the Army with key signals personnel and with trainers to prepare a large body of troops for signal duties, as was required for mass mobilisation in World War I and World War II. Interestingly, the first dedicated signal unit in the New Zealand Army came from the College Rifle Volunteers. an institution originating from three Auckland school rifle corps. Super keen Auckland solicitor Dawson loved signals. He transformed the College Rifle Volunteers in Auckland into a cycle and signalling company in 1909. And this is the first time that the word signalling appeared in a unit title. The signallers from the Post and Telegraph Corps were the service elite. There was a social arrangement between the Army and the Post and Telegraph Department which freed them from most of the military chores that technical troops endured with impatience. Yep, they were required to keep fit and to be able to defend their bases, but apart from that, they just did their specialist skill. They took their civilian expertise to war. Workers within the Post and Telegraph Department could not opt to serve in other corps. I found this history from 115 years ago so interesting, and it has huge relevance to technical experts that we have in New Zealand at the moment. Complaint about technical soldiers having to endure broader, more general military service has existed throughout my entire career. So I find it fascinating that 115 years ago they had this cracked. Something for us to learn from. From here we went to World War One, and we're still not a signal corps. Over 40% of the 1914 population of New Zealand served overseas. And of these 104,000 troops, 58% were casualties. The Divisional Signal Company of New Zealand served overseas in World War One in Egypt, Gallipoli and Europe. Various sub-elements and headquarters, as you would expect, and there were elements that were attached to the infantry, responsible for comms from the infantry brigades down to the battalions. Very quickly, in 1916, the Divisional Signal Company doubled in strength and reorganised. As the realities of war became apparent. Operators were trained in wireless procedures, but the widespread use of wireless didn't come into its own until 1918. The Kiwi signalers at Gallipoli were relentless in their bravery and dedication to the job. They did everything they could to keep the communication lines intact. At times, the signallers were in advance of the infantry, as was the case in July 1915 when Corporal Hinton and his team reached an objective before the storming party. They then sent a signal to Brigade Headquarters saying that the signal troop had occupied the position. In another incident, two linemen, only armed with a pair of pliers, captured a party of Turks. After that, all linemen carried revolvers and or rifles. And I guess we share him, but our core hero is Corporal Cyril Royston Guyton Bassett. He won the Victoria Cross for conspicuous bravery at Chunuk Bear in the Dardanelles on the 7th of August 1915, and was the only New Zealander to win a Victoria Cross in Gallipoli. In full daylight, under continuous and heavy fire, he laid a telephone line from an old position to the new position on the ridge. Under continuous heavy fire over a very, very long period of time, with friends shot all the way around, on both sides of them. Amazing soldier that went on to serve after Gallipoli. He went and served on the Western Front, where he won a further a decoration for valour, continued to serve through into World War II. He came back as a volunteer and retired as a lieutenant colonel. After we successfully evacuated from Gallipoli, New Zealand Army signallers returned to Egypt with the rest of the force. The Mounted Brigade Signal Company was then posted to the New Zealand Mounted Rifles to serve in Palestine against the Turks. The Divisional Signal Company accompanied the bulk of the expeditionary force and went to the trenches in Belgium and France. Communications in the desert were assured by a combination of wireless, heliograph, and newly acquired Triumph motorcycles, the progressive evolution of dispatch riders. Telephone lines were built in established positions, but these were often disrupted by camels. The glare of the sun and dust clouds made communicating via heliograph problematic. The war against the Turks in Sinai and Palestine was mobile and reliant on wireless communications. Lieutenant Colonel Powers recorded many instances where wireless signals made the difference between victory and failure. One such example was in 1916. He says, "On the 19th of July, at 4:15, an aeroplane reconnaissance with Brigadier Chaytor observing discovered long lines of Turks advancing westward over the desert in the vicinity of Bir Salman. Over a frontage of approximately 8 miles. This was startling information. No one had any idea that there was an advance coming from the Turks. They quickly sent this information to divisional headquarters by 6 o'clock and by wireless immediately to the 2nd Light Horse Brigade, who had already left Romani on a reconnaissance and they were to go as far as this area. Our wireless provided the warning that allowed the Turks to be challenged and defeated at the Battle of Romani. Motorcycle dispatch riders also came into their own when the brigade left the desert and reached the coast, and they rarely won their spurs at the Battle of Gaza in 1917. The Mounted Brigade Signal Troop ended World War I in the Jordan Valley, servicing an augmented and now cosmopolitan brigade. 32 signalers now maintained 110 miles of cable, operated a 30-line exchange, ran a wireless station, commanded visual stations, provided carrier pigeons and motorcycle dispatch riders. The signalers who accompanied the 1st NZ Division to France in 1916 experienced a very different war. The Divisional Signal Company was doubled in strength with 3 brigade signal sections to support war in all the horrors of the trenches. Disruption of the line was the foremost issue, with enemy bombardment playing havoc with line communications. Linemen routinely risked their lives to maintain the line. Some were gassed as they crawled through bomb craters and trenches, pulling their D5 wire with them. Any advance was quickly followed by signalers laying hundreds of yards of new line all around the trenches. Line was routinely buried 6 to 8 feet deep near the front lines. And the Germans proved adept at intercepting Allied communications. Poorly insulated circuits, too close to enemy listening posts, carried through conductive soil. Technology brought the fullerphone, which helped reduce the threat of interception. But the Allies also used other means of communication. Pigeons were tried. Oddly enough, pigeons were prone to disorientation by the noise of battle, or they were shot down. Lamp signalling was used. Dispatch riders, messenger dogs. Messenger dogs' effectiveness was reduced by the tendency of frontline soldiers to interrupt them by patting them and offering them biscuits and water. So, most signalling in France relied on line and runners. Eventually, wireless was used extensively in the Western Front in 1918, following the release of skilled signallers from the Middle East. By the end of World War I, the need for an independent signal corps had become increasingly obvious, and just 3 years after the armistice, the New Zealand Corps of Signals was born on the 1st of June 1921. This saw 3 depots formed, the Northern Depot in Auckland, Central of Wellington, and the Southern Depot in Christchurch. Then we had the interwar. It was characterized by rationalization of military numbers and funding. As the economic and social impacts of post-war and then the Depression increasingly saw a further reduction of the numbers of people in the service and people actively participating in territorial training. The range of equipment was woeful, and the quality of training was even worse. Soldiers weren't paid, and they were expected to fund their own transport and rationing while they were at training. Thankfully, for the New Zealand Corps of Signals, the Post and Telegraph Department were very enthusiastic and very cooperative, and they enabled signals to have a better outcome. They gave any of their workers who served with the Army leave with pay. They also guaranteed that all officers and NCOs who needed annual refresher courses would be freed up with pay to attend the courses. The Army and the New Zealand Post Telegraph Service worked together to find a flexible approach where they would sequence people coming so that it didn't disrupt the service of communications across the country. Training and equipment were both very simple and rudimentary. Major General Nauder from Royal Signals, he summed it up perfectly. He said the invention of the thermionic valve in 1906 led to a remarkable series of innovation in civil telecommunication practices. These made their appearance from 1914 onwards. Long-range telephony, modern wireless technique, radio telephony, multi-channel carrier telephone systems, and even television. All of these innovations had a profound effect on military communication methods. However, mostly due to financial stringency, they weren't used very well. So back in New Zealand, the Northern Depot practiced line drills with a horse-drawn cable wagon and had a basic wireless set to train on. They had flags of various sizes, they still had heliographs and shutter lamps, all left over from World War I. In the mid-20s, the wireless equipment was all recalled. So the Northern Depot held a raffle, and then they bought parts from the proceeds of that raffle to then build their own radios so they could continue training. So in addition to not a lot of very old equipment and very outdated training, the Corps directors found that the territorial system didn't allow enough time to train signals people to the right level of proficiency. They made a recommendation that 129 hours of training was a minimum requirement for signals purposes. The formal response from Army headquarters was that everyone else could do their training in 78 hours, so just make do. And that was the situation. That was how we were set up for World War II. World War II marked a huge step up in the way war was waged, including the advent of complex signals intelligence that enabled the Allies to penetrate German and Japanese codes, allowing warning of German movements and the repositioning of American naval limited resources. World War II was a wireless war, and New Zealand Signal Corps had to learn and upskill its people very, very quickly. The 202 men in the main draft for divisional signals in 1939 received a welcome boost in equipment from the British Army when they arrived in Egypt, including wireless trucks and Norton motorcycles for dispatch riders. The motorbikes in particular were prized because there were no motorbikes issued back in New Zealand. So finally they could practice their job. As always, I really like the stories of the soldiers, and there's a story of Sig Helm, signal dispatch rider, who arrived in Daba with some dispatches to the headquarters of the NZ Division, cross-legged on the high saddle of a camel, rode up to a colonel, gave the Arabic word to make the camel fold its legs up, jumped off and handed the message over, just all nonchalant, and walked off with the camel again. Divisional signals make really good use of their time in Egypt to train, but several corps members also jump at opportunities to get stuck in quicker, including volunteering for the long-range desert group. I like the story of Lance Corporal Don Cambridge, who was seconded to the Sudan Defence Force as officer commanding the Sudanese Defence Force signals, jumping from Lance Corporal up to Lieutenant Colonel. It was only meant to be a few weeks of common, and he ended up running and establishing Sudanese Signal Corps for 9 months as a Lance Corporal. And then oddly, when it was time for him to come back in, he was worried that he was going to be kept as a Lieutenant Colonel. And so he made a really big deal that, no, I'm actually a Lance Corporal, which I found interesting. In 1941, the 2nd New Zealand Division arrived in Greece as part of a 56,000-strong British Empire force to counter Germany's impending arrival. The German invasion arrived less than a month later, with the Luftwaffe air control and the quantity and speed of German armour soon pushing the Allies back. The 2nd New Zealand Division began a fighting withdrawal, with the signallers responsible for makeshift temporary communications. They patched cable into civilian circuits. They laid cable along defensive lines that had just been abandoned. They attempted to maintain comms with inadequate wireless equipment. The orderly withdrawal very soon became a rout. And as a part of the rapid evacuation, the order went out that all signals equipment was to be destroyed. Some unit commanders tried to preserve their sets, but as they got down to the coast, given a choice between evacuating soldiers and signals equipment, most of it was destroyed. From Greece, as I'm sure you know, the bulk of New Zealanders went to Crete. And Major General Freiburg was the commander of the 2nd NZ Division, became the commander of the Crete Force, charged with defending the island. We know that Freiburg, his Kiwis and the other Allied forces were unsuccessful. A key point that he made afterwards was the lack of signals equipment as a key contributing factor to the loss of Crete. There were 100-odd New Zealand signallers at Crete working with telephone and cable, but there wasn't enough wireless. The German air attacks disrupted the mostly line communications, and so signal equipment and the lack of transport were key problems throughout. When the Germans destroyed line circuits, wireless and runners were the only means of communication left open. Dispatch riders tried to bridge the gap, but very quickly they were targets for German paratroops. So ultimately the lack of adequate communication plan fundamentally undermined Freiburg's defence of the Malinae airfield. This allowed the Germans to establish a bridgehead and subsequently take all of Crete. Another core anecdote. The Galatos Road was threatened by German paratroops during the airborne invasion of Crete. J section of the divisional signals was ordered to a defensive position overlooking the road. The signal officer, little knowledge of infantry tactics, was putting his men out as best as he could when another party came up under another officer, junior in rank. The signal officer suggested to the newly arrived subaltern, "Surely you know more about this sort of thing than I do. I'll put my section underneath you." This newly arrived subaltern looked mystified, and he asked the signal officer who he was. The signal officer said, "I'm only the signal officer." The other officer replied, "Only the signal officer? Good lord, I'm only the bandmaster." It was really clear that the standard of communications had to improve. So subsequently a school of signals was established, and they were running 12-week courses to members of the corps and regimental signalers. Initially the content was really dated, too much emphasis on flags, semaphore and Morse, but all of this changed. in 1941 in Libya under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Agar. Very soon he had them using vehicle dispersal, separate frequencies by day and night, to try and keep up with the hard, mobile form of desert warfare. An enduring thing, the army communicators consistently contributed with rifles, as well as signals doing whatever was required on the ground. During 1942, German direction finding, so electronic warfare, continued to improve. And they continued to work on direction and location finding of wireless sets. To counter this, call signs were changed daily, frequency of transmission, strength of signals were also altered. These are all sound principles that still endure to this day. In preparation for the El Alamein offensive, three armoured command vehicles were allocated to the division, copying the way the Germans did it. They were fitted with wireless sets, driven by signals drivers, and they provided General Freiberg with a mobile communication network and command and control over his brigade, his artillery, engineers, armour and reconnaissance, all at the flick of a switch. Before El Alamein, Freiberg had maintained a static headquarters, and he just moved around in a staff car, chased by a staff officer in the wireless rover. Communication was haphazard and unreliable. Brigade commanders on the ground often made decisions in the absence of consultation with Freiberg that they later regretted. After the success of his mobile command and control approach at El Alamein, Freiberg maintained the mobile technical headquarters approach throughout the rest of the North African campaign and right through to the Italian campaign. Alright, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip really quickly through. Really good stuff happening in the Pacific whilst the war was happening in Europe. There was a whole lot of communications, training set up in New Zealand to prepare reinforcements. There was a lot of electronic warfare and signals intelligence set up. To provide intercepts of any Japanese naval movement in the South Pacific. In addition, a number of Royal New Zealand, Corps of New Zealand signals at that time were also part of the Coast Watchers, and some of them lost their lives executed by the Japanese at Tarawa. These were New Zealand Post and Telegraph Department experts who volunteered and went out in the middle of nowhere, living in the really arduous circumstances. When the risk of Japanese reprisals was made really clear to them, they were given a chance to evacuate, and all bar one stayed, which speaks volumes about their bravery and their commitment. World War II ends, and Her Majesty King George VI, recognising the hard work done by New Zealand Signal Corps, issued a command that the Prefect Royal was added to the Corps. It was seen as an acknowledgement of the hard work done up to that date, and also as a mark of faith in the Corps' future. And some 75 years later, we still carry the Royal Prefix with pride. Post-World War II, the now Royal New Zealand Signals Corps had a number of people attached to the Army of Occupation in Japan, J-Force, and they served in Japan for a number of years. I apologise, but I'm conscious of time. When North Korea invaded South Korea, New Zealand raised a volunteer force to contribute to the United Nations Police Action Force. I'm sure you know that the Kiwi contingent was known as K-Force. Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals' initial component was two officers and 62 soldiers, mostly again from the Post and Telegraph Department. Korea was a terrible war they unwittingly walked into one of the worst winters in Korean history, and it turned out that the weather and the topography was terrible, both for the communications but also for the equipment, the antiquated post-World War II equipment that we still had. VHF was the backbone of America's communications. Awesome. Provides links over rivers, across mountains, ship to shore. Real advance in communication. The Kiwis didn't have VHF. We continued with World War II era wireless, line and dispatch riders on motorbikes. The roads and tracks were covered with ice, snow and slush, and so soon they replaced the jeeps with correction, the motorbikes with jeeps. But these dispatch riders were rushing messages up to 30 and 40 miles. Lieutenant Clark, a Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals officer, who, as I read through the book, featured prominently in a number of campaigns afterwards, he relates that at times the batteries operating the telephone systems would freeze overnight, rendering the telephone exchanges useless. The damp cold would corrode the contact points, and the wireless on the wireless sets, they didn't have enough cold clothing, they didn't have enough wireless equipment. The equipment, the number 19 Mark III wireless set that they were issued in support of 16th Field Regiment had been built by the Canadians for the Russians during World War II. They still had Cyrillic script painted on them. Luckily, and again, I love these themes, because things like this continue to this day. Lieutenant Clark, just down the road, the 2nd Marine Division, United States, they'd previously served in World War in World War II in New Zealand, so they Kiwi sort of knew them. Lieutenant Clark and the signal sergeant, he knew that the Americans didn't get much whiskey given to them. So the two of them loaded up a trailer full of whiskey, took it over to the Marines, and they returned back to Kiwi Lions with a trailer loaded with ground-to-air radios, the latest American telephones, and reels of beautiful lightweight assault cables. The communication support to 16th Field Regiment improved overnight. When the service, when a nation doesn't provide, the Kiwi on the ground will find a way. There were Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals people there with 16th Field Regiment when they fought against overwhelming odds at Kepyong. And then after that, the remaining signals PERS were rolled into a Commonwealth Division Signal Regiment with the Canadians and Royal Signals. They stayed there until 1954, but the last Corps of Signals people didn't leave until 1957. From there, Malaya. 1955, the SAS go in, again, real bad communication equipment, World War II era sets that are not made for the conditions that they found in the jungle. In 1957, the New Zealand's contribution was increased, and a regular force infantry battalion was sent in. Attached to them were Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals volunteers who were seconded to the infantry to provide communications. They undertook a concentrated period of pre-deployment training to get themselves ready for the jungle. Naturally, this included advanced training in Wairuru with snow clinging to their tents. The comms problem that they landed on was epic. It was detailed, as detailed in the British handbook, 4/5 of the land is trackless, evergreen forest and undergrowth. 100 feet above the ground, the trees make a solid roof of green, shutting out the sky. From their branches, curtains of vine creepers join the undergrowth to make a jungle so dense that a standing man is invisible at 25 yards. The average room temperature is over 35 degrees, and torrential rain falls almost every day. Really arduous time over there. The The SIGs attached to infantry realised that in addition to their communication skills, they also had to get really, really fit. Great story I love here. Signals operator Sig Frank Burden. He's out in the jungle, attacked by a tiger while he's sleeping. Fortunately, mosquito net was protecting him enough so that his yells woke up other people, and then they fired off a machine gun and the tiger ran away. He's the only communicator in the patrol, so even though he's like shocked and he's badly mauled, he's the one who has to then jump on the radio, send a message to get his Kazi back to take him away. Resilient. The Kiwis on the ground learned the realities of jungle communications. They experimented, they discarded, they manufactured, they hung weird contraptions under the wings of airplanes and helicopters. They struggled with army bureaucrats who wanted written proposals, trials, and steering committees. And once again, they were forced to resort to grovelling and bottles of whiskey to get the stuff that they needed. Again, in really, really challenging circumstances, did an amazing job. I'll move on from Malaya. Vietnam. The Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals support in Vietnam was a bit more piecemeal, but a number of Corps people were attached to combat arms throughout. I'm short of time. When I'm reading through the history of what these guys did on the ground, it blows my mind. I really wish that I'd read this book earlier and I could meet Mike Galluli. He was originally a signal officer who was attached to 16th Field Regiment, there to provide comms. By the end of his third day in country, in Vietnam, he was directing fire against the Viet Cong. Through his 1 year and 1 day tour, he saw his task as the provision of whatever artillery support he was able to rustle up in time to support an infantry company engaged in patrols, ambushes, and observation intelligence. Amazing. The heroes that I've learned about through this blow my mind. Once again, the connection to the Post and Telegraph Department remained really strong. As a 16-year-old, he was trained by them before going into compulsory military training and doing war SIGs training. Amazing. All right. Cambodia was really interesting because no one had deployed for a really long time. So this is the largest New Zealand deployment since the Vietnam War, and for the Corps of Signals, it's even more important because they had such a strong New Zealand Corps contingent there, some of which are still serving today. 40 soldiers went across from the Corps of Signals, and when you hear the stories about what they did, it's insane. They were pretty much bomb burst and set out in small groups all over the place, not seen by other Kiwis or even by other allies for up to weeks, with only a tenuous HF link to keep so people knew they were still alive. They worked closely with the Australians, and again, an enduring theme, they found that they were highly efficient by international standards. Just two or three Kiwi signalers could provide the same amount of communication support to an area equivalent to that covered by a much larger signals unit. Cambodia was really challenging, technically really challenging environmental setting, but it gave the Royal New Zealand Corps of Signals a real opportunity to test their comm skills in an operational setting. And in total, 70 Corps people served during the two rotations in Cambodia. And I do apologise, I'm skipping quite quickly because I do want to get to Cambodia finishes, and then the army just went through this crazy period where there's just trips happening. And I've just listed some. There are so many more missions that that signals PERS went away on. the task that we had to do it really hasn't changed since World War One, just the means of which we did them. Overseas, a whole lot of things from sort of more conventional all the way through to sort of unconventional warfare, supporting things like the riots in Tonga and Nuku'alofa in 2006, and then a whole lot of other natural disasters. So super busy, people going away all the time doing really, really good comms things. And now here we are, 2023. What we do, in a lot of ways, isn't really much different to what I've read about in the last 160 years. But just once again, we're trying to leverage technology to maximise the advantages for the supported commander. You would have seen that for the longest time, RF circuits, VHF, HF, this was the key for signals. That backbone link is now provided by satellite links or mobile communications to provide laptops, applications, so that dots on maps or video talks so commanders can see their people. As the technology has changed, as the nature of how we want to fight this change, our trades have changed. We still have a predominantly radio or bearer sort of trade that wouldn't really seem too different to the same sorts of trades all the way through. But we have soldiers who deploy servers and laptops. We have systems engineers who just do amazingly geeky things behind the scenes. We have an electronic warfare trade. We have so much information coming in these days that we have a separate trade that just manages information, who were rebranded admin. And it's really clear to see that we also need a cyber trade now as well. The key, the technology is just bits of kit. The bit that pulls it all together and makes anything possible is the quality of the soldiers that join. They're just as innovative, they're just as hardworking as the men and women that I've read about over the last 160 years of service. It's an honour to work with them. I really do feel like New Zealand's in really good hands with the quality of the soldiers that are still joining us. I'm going to stop there because I realise that there's probably people here who know a lot more about a lot of what I've said. Open for any questions, in particular for anything in the last 20 odd years, which is what I've lived through.
Got a few Jimmies in the audience. Are there any questions that anybody wants to ask of Jared?
Yes.
What's your take on the use of Starlink by the Ukrainian Army as a use of Starlink terminals by the Ukrainian Army as a changing method of communication?
It's funny actually. We've just been talking about Starlink at work. Look, the Ukrainians have been incredibly innovative. They've had to be. They have replicated a course, say for like a javelin, which would take 4 weeks. Replicated that with some YouTube clips that people can watch. So the use of Starlink, look, it's really easy access. It's got amazing coverage. It'd be really interesting to see exactly how they're using it to counter. Or to appreciate and counter the signals intelligence or electronic warfare threat that it might pose. But the Ukrainians are doing a lot of really innovative things on the ground, which I think are really causing us to think, which is great. I haven't really answered.
Dennis,
is that Starlink secure?
Is any means secure? So generally, the way I think about it is we create a pipe, whatever that pipe is, be it VHF radio, be it Starlink, be it, you know, some of the military satellites that we use, and then on top of that, we add some crypto devices on either side, and sometimes we'll double those, and even then, you know, there's information that you can get without seeing anything as it. So what we're learning from the Ukrainians is you've got to move, because it doesn't take. I mean, it's actually a little bit scary to see the way some of the warfare is being fought. The proliferation of these drones that are everywhere, with videos that can then be sent back. They can see who's there, because everyone's got a phone and it's linked to a social media account, and so they can find out who you are, and then they can take pictures of you, or they can go in and they can find out who your contacts are and contact your family back home and say, we're about to kill you, kill your brother, your husband. That's quite scary. So, really good lessons for us to learn down here in Aotearoa, to think about what we need to do differently.
Any other questions? Sort of mindful of the time, and some people do want to get away. Yeah.
If you're up against a sophisticated enemy like the Russians, you could target radio transmission very quickly in some high profile cases where people have been assassinated. I think it checks you with your cell phone on and something going on within seconds. It's getting to the point where turning the radio on to become almost an instant death sentence.
Yeah, so we're in an interesting time where we're increasingly reliant on technology to do things. I mean, we see it in our daily lives, and I love it. I can messenger chats with my 91-year-old grandmother. It's wonderful what technology can do, but increasingly it makes us vulnerable as well as we rely on it. And so we find ourselves in the army having to consciously think about a dual approach. So we want the technology, we want to do all the things that it can enable us to do, but we also have to be really cognizant of what vulnerabilities it opens up and be prepared to drop to dumber means. Some of which might be, you know, the re-emergence of things like HF. Even things like Morse, which I don't actually have to learn anymore, I've just got an app. And I can just type it in, and it can do Morse for me. But the signal is really, really, really small, so it's much, much harder to detect. So you have to think about the way that you want to do things, and where you can, try and hide beneath the noise floor. But it's hard. And against a sophisticated enemy, and, you know, Russia's pretty sophisticated. China scares me. Yeah, we're just a rounding error in terms of the size of our defence force.
Right, well, look, thanks very much, Jared. Can you all please join me in thanking Jared very much for putting that presentation together while he's still trying to maintain his new job in Capability Branch, Headquarters of New Zealand Defence Force. But, Jared, thanks very much, and all the best for the next 100 years.
Oh, thank you.